Good morning. The court has only one matter on its submission docket today, and that is docket number 10-0121, the Finance Commission of Texas, the Credit Union Commission of Texas, and Texas Bankers Association versus Valerie Norwood, Elise Shows, Marianne Robles Valdez, Bobby Martin, Pamela Cooper, and Carlos Rivas from Travis County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for this argument. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in 10-0121, the Finance Commission of Texas and others versus Valerie Norwood and others.
May it please the court, Mr. Green and Mr. Enoch will present argument for petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Green will open with the first 8 minutes, and Mr. Green will present the rebuttal.
May it please the court, the borrowers seek extraordinary relief in this lawsuit. They ask the court to invalidate the commission's interpretations of the home equity lending provisions of the Constitution after the commissions were given express constitutional authority to interpret those very provisions. Even assuming ordinary deference principles apply, all of the challenged interpretations must be upheld because they are reasonable and consistent with the Constitution.
So when, if ever, is judicial review appropriate?
Your Honor, fortunately, it isn't even necessary to reach the question of whether judicial review is totally excluded in this case, because the commission's challenged interpretations satisfy the ordinary deference standard that was articulated by the court in Railroad Commission v. Texas Citizens last term. That was the court's seminal opinion on agency deference interpretation. Now, the interpretations here were enacted under formal notice and comment procedures.
So counsel, we apply the deference principles when agencies are interpreting statutes. This is an agency interpretation of a constitutional provision. Is there a difference?
I don't think there's any difference, Your Honor, because
is there authority from this court for that position?
There isn't any authority because this is a unique provision. This is Section 50U that gave the commission's express constitutional authority to interpret the Constitution.
Excuse me, can I ask you, are there any similar constitutional provisions where the power to interpret the Constitution has been delegated in this way?
Expressly to an agency, Your Honor? No, I don't believe so.
How about in any other state or in the federal government? Do you know anything that's like this?
I'm not aware of a similar provision, but the reason that this provision was enacted was because home equity lending itself is governed by the Constitution, and for an agency to be able to issue definitive interpretations of what it meant, it had to receive its power from the Constitution itself.
But the question that began argument from Justice Medina, I'm curious what your answer is. Is there judicial review or not in this instance?
Your Honor, I believe that you can apply the Texas Citizen Standard and apply judicial review to the interpretations because it's a similar situation to when an agency is empowered to construe its enabling statute. Here, the commissions were given power to interpret the constitutional provisions. And so if you apply the ordinary deference standard to the interpretations, you can uphold them because they're reasonable and consistent with the Constitution.
Is that the only factor that is similar than the power to interpret where the legislature tasked the commission with this?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the question is really only, were the interpretations enacted under a formal rulemaking type procedure? And there's no dispute here that they were. There's no challenge that our interpretations didn't go through formal notice and comment properly. So I think that once you answer that question, the only question becomes, can our interpretations be reconciled with the Constitution?
Well, and it seems that the definition comes from one part. And the argument on the other side is that the definition of interest is also in the usury part, which is intended to protect consumers. So if they're right, you lose.
Now, as far as the interest interpretations, Your Honor, the interest definition that the commission's used is the definition of interest. It's the only one contained in the finance code, and it applies well beyond the usury context to things that have nothing to do with consumer protection, like judicial prejudgment interest. And so the commissions took this 100-year-old definition of interest that has been in the statutes in virtually the same form for all that time.
It's like a smokescreen, though, because you have fees here that are also tacked on. And the argument is that the fees are also included in the broad term of interest.
That's not right, Your Honor. There are fees that will be capped under the commission's definition of
what
interest.
What fees are those, if you can detail those?
It's hard to give specific names to fees because the test actually looks to the substance of the transaction.
Well, you just said there are fees that would be subject to the cap, and I'm curious what fees those are.
What types of fees?
Sure.
Anything that's extended that is independent from the loan itself that would be charged irrespective of whether the loan is made. And one varies. Any third party, like attorney's fees that are passed on through the lender to the borrower, those are going to be capped.
Counsel, which of those fees are involved in this case? I know in Tarver, there was a discount to buy down the loan percentage, and that was held to be interest. Now, there was a real controversy in that case because the borrower sued the lender. Now, in this case, in the trial court's judgment, no one's given any relief. We don't talk about any of these plaintiffs having anything at risk in this case, no complaint. We just have a judgment declaring these rules valid and invalid. And the Court of Appeals is the same way. So up here, how do we know even what we're talking about?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. The borrowers are seeking facial relief to challenge the interpretations outright going forward. So they don't.
Do they have standing to do that? Is there any real case or controversy involved in this?
I think the threshold is pretty low in this case because they're seeking declaratory facial relief, saying that essentially the interpretations conflict with the Constitution, and so anyone will be harmed by the interpretations going forward. But you're right, there are no specific loans at issue in this case.
Mr. Green, going back to the standard, what do you make of Professor Beal's proposed alternative, and how would you fare under that?
I think that Texas Citizens answers the question. It basically says that as long as the interpretation is enacted under formal notice and comment, the only question becomes whether it can be reconciled with the Constitution. And here, the borrowers they failed to show that any other definition of interest was intended by the legislature. The commission's used the statutory definition of interest, which has been applied by this court and other courts for over 100 years, so there's a whole lot of precedent and context by which you can take the definition of interest that we've used and just apply it in the home equity lending context.
Doesn't that just basically nullify the restrictions on the fees?
No, Your Honor. There are fees that will continue to be capped under the interest definition that the commissions have used here. Again, any third-party fees that are passed on by the lender are not consideration for making the loan because the third party isn't extending the loan. And things that are passed on directly by the lender that are independent and separate from the loan itself will still constitute fees. And so it's not true that the interest interpretations that we've used here will totally negate the fee cap. And if you look at the Fifth Circuit case that actually considered the question on an Erie challenge or on an Erie guest case, Cerda, which we cited in our briefs, the court held that it just simply makes sense to define interest and fees the same way that they've been applied and defined in every other lending context. It shouldn't be different for home equity lending because it's difficult to make sense out of what would become interest in that context.
So the commission's position on review is that the court should just not decide what the scope of review is.
I think that you can decide the case under Texas Citizens without having to answer the harder question about whether judicial review is available. It is a real legitimate question because the commissions were given express constitutional authority to interpret specific provisions of the Constitution here. And so it creates a unique issue that fortunately doesn't necessarily have to be answered because, again, under the Texas Citizens standard, our interpretations plainly must be upheld because the borrowers have not proven that they cannot be reconciled with the Constitution.
Well, staying with the issue of the standard of review, our district courts have the authority to interpret statutes, right?
That's correct.
And we review those on appeal. Is there anything in the constitutional provisions at issue here that preclude appellate review?
That preclude it? No, just order.
It says those institutions, those agencies have the authority after the organic statutes were enacted by the legislature to interpret the provisions, but nothing precludes judicial review in those provisions.
Nothing expressed,
it?
Your Honor, except Article 2, Section 1, the basic separation of powers clause, says that normally the judiciary exercises the judicial function except where explicitly authorized in the Constitution to another branch of government, and that's what happened here, Your Honor.
Any further questions?
I have one question about the oral loan application. Doesn't the language in 50A6MI submits an application, doesn't that imply a formal application?
I believe that, well, that provision isn't at issue anymore in this case, Your Honor. That interpretation is no longer being challenged by the borrowers in this case.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Counsel, the preceding counsel said the threshold is low for us to find a case or controversy here, and it's not raising any brief, but no one's asking for any relief here other than simply, it looks to me like, an advisory opinion out of the judiciary. Can you enlighten us on that?
Your Honor, under the TAB case, it could, as an association, it could represent parties that are similarly situated. This began as an ACORN, Association of Citizens for Reform Now, organization that then became defunct, and these individuals substituted in attempting to represent those same interests. And I have not looked at the standing or jurisdictional issue to come before the court at this point. We accepted it in that posture when it came. I like the blue chairs, by the way. Anyway, my name is Craig Enoch. I represent the Texas Bankers Association in this case. And I do think the court really does have a question that it has to address. Does it have a role in oversight of the commission's interpretation of the Constitution? And we would say, yes, it does. The Constitution does not exclude review. That's the first point. The second point is, in fact, Section 16 or Article 16, Section 50U expressly recognizes that appellate courts will have a role in review and interpreting these constitutional provisions. That's U, subparagraph 2, that it could be an interpretation made by the state agency that's delegated or by an appellate court. So there is a role, well, it seems
so
to
me. How do you read that provision? It's kind of hard to read.
Yes, it is. It's missing something.
So you think that means that the commission is like an appellate court?
I believe, Your Honor, we'd have to accept that under the Constitution, the commission does perform a role like an appellate court in interpreting the Constitution, but that does not exclude judicial review. And I'd like to take a few minutes just to sort of explore that with you. This court has faced this identical dilemma before, twice. In Poole versus Ford Motor Company, the court faced the dilemma where it did not have jurisdiction to address factual sufficiency review. But it did have the Supreme Court's proper role to see that the appellate court was applying the factual sufficiency review properly. Although that case did have some criticism to it, even the concurring opinion, Justice Gonzalez, agreed that the principle was valid, that the Supreme Court had the ultimate oversight to make sure that the reviewing court was performing its function properly. More recently, in 2009, this court ruled in In re Columbia Medical, where the trial court has complete discretion to grant a new trial. But this court said, we can't determine whether that discretion is being handled properly if the trial court isn't required to have a complete analysis of the facts and review so we can see what the reasons are and the parties know what the reasons are. The court has recognized in both cases that it's the purview of the lower court to make these decisions. But what's the proper role of the Supreme Court in its oversight is to make sure that those courts follow the principles that are to be followed in exercising their decisions.
Is there a different degree of deference that's given in these type of situations as compared to, this is a constitutional issue here. What if it's a legislative issue? Because I think there's some comment made in the dissent by Justice Perrier that because it's legislative enactment, then you get more of a broad type of discretion.
You know, I think the courts have used giving deference as kind of a thumb on the scale. But I say the bottom line on all the deference questions is really more in the language that this court has used in a number of different cases when it's doing a legal sufficiency review, which is to say, could, in this case, a commission reasonably conclude that interest means compensation for use, forbearance, or detention of money? Could a reasonable commission make that determination? And it seems to me that's the standard under the Constitution. What this court does, even when the legislature has delegated legislative authority for an agency to make some interpretations of rules and statutes. This court has used that. I think it's a similar standard that this court can use on the constitutional question.
What is your take on the standard that Professor Beal proposes?
I read Professor Beal's. He was more concerned about whether the process was handled properly, and then he says there shouldn't be a substantive review. I disagree. I believe there is a substantive review. This court has not excluded from making the substantive review, but it is unique in that the Constitution gives the authority of interpretation to the commission, and as a result, this court, in applying its duty to review the substance of what happens, to give weight to what the commission has said. And that's not to say no, that's not to say it's de novo. De novo is you now look at the Constitution, you do what you do, and you come to a conclusion of what the Constitution means. Because the Constitution gives constitutional weight to the interpretation, I suggest this court's review is, again, could a reasonable commission conclude that the interest of definition means compensation?
Assuming that's correct there, and that there is judicial review, there are other aspects of what the commission's about their interpretations, including power of attorney, and including whether the consumer can mail in the written consent for the lien. And on the latter, isn't it the case that these closings were supposed to happen at a particular place, not at home? And if you permit somebody to mail in the lien, doesn't that contravene the purpose of the legislation to begin with? You see what I mean?
Yes, Your Honor, and I see those two points that are made, and the argument is made, but I think the court does not get involved in what would be the better determination. I'd say it's really the text of the statute. Now you're looking at the mechanics of a closing. It seems to me that if the court accepts the proper role of its oversight, it then evaluates that. Could it reasonably conclude, could a commission reasonably conclude that? Once it reaches that, then the fact that that may not be wise, may not be the appropriate way.
But signing the lien is part of the closing, and the Act says that the closing has to occur at the lender's office or attorney's office or title company. And so if it's occurring at the consumer's home or a place other than those three locations, isn't that a problem?
Your Honor, admittedly, that could be a problem. But in evaluating that, you will have any number of people who are physically unable to go to a closing, are mentally aware, are alert, they know what they're doing, they are having their daughter, their husband, execute powers of attorney so that those closings can occur. I think as the court analyzes all of the factors, it will say the commission could reasonably conclude that that's appropriate. And even if this court would decide, well, we think that's not a good idea, and the constitutional review, this court would say, the wisdom of this decision is not for the court to make. Could a reasonable commission decide that question? The bottom line is, could the commissions reasonably conclude any interest is compensation for use? Forbearance, detention of money. We think that they could. We also think they could do that as to the other two rules. We do think the court does have the right to review under that standard, and we think the Court of Appeals, in its reversal of the interest, should be reversed.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Mock will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The commissions have interpreted what are some of the most important homestead protections for Texans in the Constitution. The homeowners brought this suit challenging some of those interpretations. Three of those interpretations were changed voluntarily by the commissions. Three of those interpretations challenged were mooted out by changes in the Constitution, and the remaining three are before the court today. I would like to focus this morning primarily on one of the most significant of these interpretations, the 3% fee cap. The ultimate question before the court relating to the fee cap is this. are origination fees included in the 3% fee cap? Or in plain language, is a fee to originate an origination fee?
But before we get to that, can you spend a few moments on the standard of review question and respond to the argument that it is this court's proper role, if you will, to simply ask, could a reasonable commission conclude, make the conclusions that it's made?
Yes, Your Honor. The review by this court of the commission's interpretations of the Constitution should be de novo. Now, regardless of the standard review, no deference should be given to the commissions because their interpretations are not consistent with the plain language of the Constitution. However, the reason why the standard of review should be de novo is that this court in particular, is the final arbiter of the meaning of the Constitution. It reviews constitutional interpretations by district and appellate courts de novo. And this court has never given any district or appellate courts any sort of deference in its interpretation of the Constitution. To the extent that the commissions have a quasi-judicial right to interpret the Constitution, like an appellate or district court, this review then, therefore, should be de novo.
If it's quasi-judicial, why wouldn't we then analogize to the situation Mr. Enoch brought up when we look at whether the Court of Appeals applied correctly the factual sufficiency standard? What's wrong with that argument?
Well, and I'll say, first of all, that there's nothing in 50U that elevates the commissions out of the judicial scheme. If the court were to give some sort of deference, like the Third Court of Appeals gave it, it would not be along the lines of the cases that have been mentioned before. And the reason for that is because the many cases, Texas Citizens, more in all its progeny, are specifically deference to agencies that were in charged with enforcing their own statutes. They were all agencies consistently that had additional rights, additional powers under those rules, and that is distinct and apart from what we have here today. What the commissions are doing simply is interpreting the Constitution. It is a power that is given to them by the legislature through the Constitution.
The commissions have expertise in the areas they've been authorized to interpret. Correct?
Yes, that is correct.
One of the reasons we allowed or provide for deference to those agencies when they're interpreting legislation.
Yes, and the distinction here, once again, is that the role that they have is simply to interpret. All the commissions have the right to do is to tell us what the meanings of the meaning of the words in the Constitution are. And bear in mind, of course, that when someone is violating something, they're not violating the commission's rules. They're violating the Constitution. And for that reason, this quasi-judicial role, this quasi-judicial power that they have, is like a district or appellate court, and the review should therefore be de novo.
Do you think that the people of the state, through a constitutional amendment, are able to remove the judicial review from an agency's determination like this?
Could the Constitution be changed so that the agencies no longer have the right to interpret the Constitution? Okay. Absolutely. In fact, the only reason why the commissions are able to interpret the Constitution is that they are given this specific right through the legislature appointing them to interpret the Constitution. If that were to be withdrawn, they would no longer have that right.
So in this provision where it says that the legislature gives the can enact some provision, granting the commission the right to interpret those provisions does not take it out of judicial review.
No, and I think the parties have conceded, the commissions and the Texas Bankers Association have conceded as much. It's not removing it from judicial review. The court has this right to judicial review.
The legislature was not required to delegate that authority. I presume it could have passed a statute on its own.
In order for the legislature to disrupt the balance of powers, the ability for any agency to interpret the Constitution and for those then to have significance, it would have to be a constitutional amendment that would allow the legislature to do that.
I'm not talking about the legislature interpreting, but the legislature just passed a statute saying setting out which fees would be fees and which fees would be interest.
Yes, and the only way, Your Honor, and the only way that the commissions have the right to do that is because there is a constitutional amendment allowing the commissions to interpret the Constitution. The commissions can always interpret the Constitution. The problem, of course, is that they don't have that judicial power if it is not appointed to them by the Constitution. And it is also very clear in case law that the only power that they get through a constitutional amendment like this is what is specifically in the Constitution. And the Constitution does not disrupt the judicial scheme. It doesn't give them any sort of exclusive right to do this. It doesn't do anything more than allow them to tell us what the words mean in the Constitution.
Counsel,
these are not rulemaking.
I'm not sure I understood your answer to Justice Johnson's question. Maybe I just didn't hear part of it. Could the legislature, rather than authorizing the commissions to interpret these rules, have just written a statute that said, these are fees, these are interests?
And the answer is, to the extent that it was an interpretation of the Constitution, the answer is no. What this section of the provision of the Constitution 50U allows is for the legislature to appoint an agency or agencies, and so the legislature itself could not do that. In terms of the legislature appointing itself to interpret the Constitution, again, this court is the final arbiter of what the Constitution means.
I agree with that. Now, let's hear, you want to answer the question about the origination fee, Mr. Mark?
Yes. So the ultimate question with regard to the fee caps is whether or not an origination fee falls into the 3% fee cap. Or in plain language, if a fee to originate is an origination fee. And there is only one court that is held squarely on this issue, and that is, it addresses this squarely, and that is Judge Nallen in the Thomason case.
Do you hear the commissions to agree that it would fall within the cap if it were charged by somebody other than the lender?
Sure, and of course it would fall under the cap. The question,
are we down to not just an origination fee, but an origination fee charged by the lender?
That's exactly right. And Judge Nallen had that identical issue, and Judge Nallen in the Thomason court basically said fees to originate are origination fees, and so therefore they're included in the fee cap. Now, the interesting thing about the case law on this issue is that numerous cases have also included origination fees in the fee cap. They haven't done any analysis with regard to this, but they have included them in the fee cap either automatically or by concession from the parties. So one of the questions is, what is a fee cap? What is an origination fee? A loan origination fee is a one-time fee paid upfront to the lender by the borrower before the loan is made. It is often one of the largest fees that a homeowner will pay. And some of the cases before that have been discussed by the parties illustrate this. In the Serta case, the Fifth Circuit case, for example, the homeowners paid over $10,000 in origination fees. In the Maluski case.
Stop you right there.
Yes.
Have any of these homeowners paid any origination fees in this case?
Your Honor, I would have to go back.
Is it in the record at all?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is there any record that any of these homeowners have paid any origination fees in regard to their home loans, equity loans?
I believe so, but I would have to go back and look at the record to confirm that with the court, Your Honor. All of the homeowners who were originally part of this case and the filing of this case have or have had home equity loans and would have an interest in getting a home equity loan in the future. As the commissions have conceded, the bar, in order to challenge a case through the APA and the Declaratory Judgment Act, is fairly low, and they all have an interest in the case.
So how low is it that we don't just give an advisory opinion?
It would not be an advisory opinion, Your Honor. We're asking that the court interpret the Constitution, and we believe that the court has the right to interpret the Constitution in this case, because the commissions are interpreting the Constitution and as I mentioned, a quasi-judicial power. But if you look at origination fees, if you look at those cases in particular, in the Serta case, for example, the over $10,000 that they paid was 97% of the amount that would be the 3% fee cap.
Can I ask you a question that has to do with that? As far as bank practices with regard to these fees, do you know how uniform they are? And what I'm getting at is competition in the marketplace. Is that going to help deal with this concern?
And I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure.
The whole interest issue, basically doing away with the cap, the 3% cap. And so the marketplace, the competition, is that going to help deal with that issue?
The, The reality is that a change in the fee, if the court was to get rid of the fee cap somehow through the Constitution, banks would be charging probably the same what they're charging right now. The point is that the fee cap, and banks can charge as much as they want to right now. The fee cap is not a cap on interest. What it is it allows homeowners to know what they're going to be paying. And so when they get a notice, which is required by the Constitution, one day before they show up at the closing, they can be assured that even though those numbers can change, that they will be charged no more than 3% of the fees, 3% in fees, and that has to include the origination fees by the language of the Constitution.
But what I'm saying is, if that 3% did not apply, then are those marketplace considerations going to help deal with the issues that have been raised as far as those fees being too high? How uniform is the practice? Or you may not know that.
No, and I think the result is basically a shuffling of the fees. I mean, one of the points of the fee cap was so that Texans knew up front what they were going to be charged. Now, so the point is that Texans homeowners would know that one day before they're going to close, they get a listing of all the fees, that they're not going to be charged no more than 3% in fees, but the banks can charge higher interest rates or low interest rates, you know, and it can even out. The point is to have an even ground, so that homeowners can shop around for the competitive mortgages.
Mr. Monk,
and competitive rates.
What's your answer in response to the commission's interpretation of the definition of interest has been used for over 100 years? Therefore, we should not question their interpretation.
And the response to that is all of that jurisprudence has to do with looking at that definition of interest as usury. If you'll turn to page one of the Texas of the handout. And this is the Texas Constitution, because this goes to the heart of this issue. This is the plain language of the Constitution. And it says in this portion, the fee cap, that a home equity loan is valid on the condition that it does not require a home, the owner or an owner's spouse to pay, in addition to any interest, fees to any person that are necessary to originate, evaluate, maintain, record, insure, or service the extension of credit that exceed in the aggregate 3% of the original principal amount of the extension of the credit. The point is to limit fees to originate. And there is nothing.
You sort of mentioned that there might be some fee shifting, but is there any way for a fee charged by the lender to benefit anybody else? It's always going to just benefit the lender, right?
No, there could be third parties. You could pay the a fee to a lender that would go to someone else. But the point of the language is that if it is a fee to originate, then it should be considered in the fee cap. And there is nothing in there's not a shred of legislative history from the 1997 law, committee reports, statements on the floor of each chamber, description of the protections, and from public statements about the fee cap prior to the voters actually voting on this law that supports that these fees were not to be included in the fee cap. All of this legislative history supports that this was the intent of the legislature, and this was the understanding of the voters. And so we get back to, so how is it that the commissions consider that an origination fee is no longer in the fee cap? If you look at page two of the handout, you'll see that this is what the commissions are talking about. They define interest using this portion of the Texas Finance Code, which is a definition of interest that has been defined by courts over many, many years for the purpose of usury, a cap on interest. And one of the main reasons—
Isn't it also used, though, in other provisions of the subtitle not addressing usury? I mean, it's also used in other contexts.
It is also used in other contexts, but primarily it is used in the context of usury. Because the point is that it's a cap on interest. But the reason why the language of the Constitution included "and any interest" in that description before it got to the describing fees that originate, maintain, etc., was because the legislature wanted to make sure that fee cap provision was not a cap on interest. That was the whole point. And the problem is that the commissions have used a technical definition here that essentially defeats the purpose of the constitutional protection. And if you look, if you look at the actual definition under this provision of the finance code, it actually looks fairly benign. Interest means compensation for the use, forbearance, or detention of money. And you have to look at the case law to realize that essentially what this is, it's clearly a cap on interest. It's meant to be a very broad definition. And the commissions concede that, in fact, an origination fee paid to a lender would fall outside of the fee cap as a result of their definition. And so they have chosen a technical definition that defeats the purpose of the fee cap. Again, there's no shred of legislative history in 1997 that would support this, that would support that there would be exceptions to origination fees falling outside of the fee cap.
But let me be sure that I understand how you think this works, and that is that is there any way for someone other than the lender to be benefited by an origination fee charged by the lender?
Sometimes third parties who might be doing a lot of the work in a broker, for example, setting up the loan, might get a fee that could be called an origination fee. But again, the interesting thing is that no court has found that origination fees fall outside of the fee cap, and that is indicative of how Texans will be charged fees, higher fees, if this court were to validate this rule.
Well, that's the part I'm struggling with, because the cap, clearly the commissions agree that the cap applies to origination fees charged by people other than the lender. Is there any way that now fees that would come under that cap can be moved out of the cap and into interest? That's the question.
But if you look at the definition of the Constitution, it says fees to any person. That would include the lender, that would include a third party, that are necessary to originate.
I take your argument, but I'm just wondering still, is there any way to shift it? Is there any way that, given the Commission's position, that fees that would otherwise be capped would be moved over under the category of interest and avoid the cap?
And if the question is, if there's any other way, if this court were to find, well, first of all, the language doesn't allow it in the Constitution. Second of all, in order for that to happen, I think the legislature would have, and the people would have to vote on a change to the Constitution that would state specifically that, you know, fees to a third party are to be included in the fee cap, fees to the lender are not. But it doesn't do that. And for that reason, the origination fees have to be included in the fee cap.
What would be the impact on the industry and on consumers if you do not prevail here?
I think there would be higher fees. Because all indication from the cases that are before the court and our own experience is that lenders are not yet pushing origination fees outside of the fee cap. All the cases that have considered it have simply put it inside the fee cap. And what will happen is that fees for Texans will raise. Now, one of the questions that the court may have is what would be the definition of interest? And I provide four different examples of in the Constitution where the definition of interest that would apply would relate to the rate in the note, and that's the only way those sections would make sense. Now, I only have 1 minute remaining, so I want to make one point, and that is that there is a middle ground here, and that is the court could find, per the plain meaning of the Constitution, that fees to originate, evaluate, maintain, record, insure, or service a loan are not interest. It could find that that's the plain meaning of the Constitution and therefore be included in the fee cap. And if the court were to do that, the Commission's own definition of interest, which includes the phrase as interpreted by the courts, would then be valid. And in fact, that phrase in the rule invites this action. If the court were to do this, it could mean that the Commission's fee cap rules were consistent with the plain meaning, plain language of the Constitution. If the court were not to do that, these rules are clearly invalid and in violation of the plain language of the Constitution.
I doubt the Commissions would agree that that's a middle ground.
I would agree, Your Honor, because they would exclude origination fees paid to a lender from the fee cap.
It seems to me that if the only concern is higher fees, then, as Justice Lerman, I think, was alluding to, then the marketplace will take care of that, because consumers will shop for better rates and better fees, and it won't be an issue.
But the real problem, Your Honor, with regard to the fee cap is not that this does not keep lenders from raising their rates. It doesn't.
What it does is it
allows homeowners to know what they're buying, and it allows so that it's not the lenders that have the best sales force or the pushiest sales force getting the customers, but Texas homeowners knowing exactly what they're getting.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Mock.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to start with the fact that de novo review simply cannot be the standard here. The commission's authority comes from the Constitution, and the commissions were given express interpretive authority over these provisions. It certainly makes no sense that an enforcement agency given statutory authority to regulate has more or should be entitled to more deference than the commissions who have direct constitutional authority to interpret the home equity law.
I understand the argument, it just can't be that way, but I don't understand the argument from the text because it seemed to me that the counsel for the other petitioner was correct about part two of paragraph U, and it seems to say, although it's sort of oddly written, but it seems to say that basically the commission is taking on the role of an appellate court. And if that's the case, and all it's doing is interpreting the Constitution, if it were another appellate court, we would look at it de novo.
What that provision says is that if a loan complies with an interpretation that had already been issued in a court of appeals through litigation or through the commissions, that loan needs to be upheld. But it doesn't say that you go and undo ordinary separation of powers type principles. And that under ordinary circumstances, courts provide deference to a formal interpretation of the law that's issued by an agency. And again, here, the commission's power comes from the Constitution itself, not just from a statute.
I still don't understand what you said. It says made by a state agency, all right, the commission, to which the power of interpretation is delegated as provided by this subsection, all right, or by an appellate court of this state or the United States.
Right.
So if we're going to look at an appellate court of this state of the United States and they say the Constitution means X, we're going to look at that de novo. But you say if it's the commission, no, it's a much higher standard.
Now, Your Honor, what litigation may still arise over the meaning of the home equity lending provisions, and when it does, once it's reached a court of appeals and a court of appeals has issued an opinion of law about that loan, all that provision says is that future transactions may rely upon that provision and they have safe harbor, even if subsequently some court may theoretically disagree with that opinion. That provision just says that future loans are entitled to rely upon the provision. But again, assuming that reasonableness review applies here, the interpretations that exist here that were being challenged existed in advisory authority before the commissions were given express constitutional authority to interpret the Constitution. These are the commission's interpretations that are being looked at here existed in virtually the same substantive form before the commissions were then given express constitutional authority to essentially turn those advisory opinions into law. And so I think if anything speaks to the reasonableness.
I don't understand. What do you mean by that? You mean the definition of interest predated this authority?
The commission's interpretations existed in regulatory advisory form from 1998 until 2003 when the legislature then gave the commission's authority to essentially transform those existing interpretations into law. And so, Your Honor, I'd like to just speak about the interest definition for a second. Counsel implies that it only applies in the usury context or that it mostly does. This court has looked at the definition of interest that's used in the finance code and applied it to things like judgment interest that have nothing to do with consumer protection. The simple fact is that the interest definition here is the only interest definition that exists in the finance code. And all the commissions are doing is taking that basic definition and saying, let's use the same thing in the context of home equity lending.
But the problem is the Constitution differentiates between interest and origination fees.
Right, and under the commission's rules, origination fees can can still be capped so long as they're not interest. Anytime an origination fee is charged by a third party, like a broker that brokers the a loan, that's going to end up getting capped. If a lender charges something that they denominate an origination fee, often it is nothing more than interest. In other words, it's just a different type of charge that's made for extending the loan. But even under the commission's interpretations, if something is denominated an origination fee that is actually charged for something that's independent of a loan, that, because the again, the interpretations look to substance.
Would that be true even if the even if it was charged by the lender?
Yes. I mean, in most cases, I think an origination fee is only charged in connection with actually extending a loan, so it will be interest.
So the commission's position is that if the lender charges an origination fee but pays it somehow to a third party, that would not be interest.
That's right. So at the end of the day, the borrowers are trying to use the courts to effectuate their desired policy here, but the bottom line is they failed to show that the commission's interpretations are impossible to reconcile with the Constitution, and we submit that that's the standard that the court should apply. So because all of the challenged interpretations are, they reasonably interpret the home equity lending provisions of the Constitution, the court should render judgment denying the borrower's claims and upholding the interpretations.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted. Before we close, the court would like to acknowledge our senior colleague, Justice Nathan Hett. He began his service to the Texas judiciary and to the people of this state on September 1, 1981, as judge of the 95th District Court in Dallas. That's 30 years. He then served as the justice of the Court of Appeals for the 5th District of Texas and is the senior appellate justice in active service in the state of Texas. Nathan has been the court's liaison to the rules of procedure during his 22 years on this court and successfully led the effort to save access to justice funding in this last legislative session. The court dedicates the opening of this term of court to our friend and colleague, Nathan Heck. Thank you. And that concludes today's oral argument. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, now stands adjourned.